Today, Does Not Compute is brought to you by Linode. Linode lets you spin up new servers in just seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, compute power, and node location. They've got 8 data centers to choose from, and their plans start at just $10 a month. All their plans and add-on services are billed hourly with a monthly cap, so you only pay for the resources you use. Their add-ons are pretty great, too. Automated backups, node balancers to help you easily scale, and Longview, which gives you detailed system metrics. Since these are full private virtual machines, you can run just about anything on them, like Docker containers, a private VPN or Git server, or whatever other software your next project needs. Linode provides native SSD storage for every machine running on Intel Xeon E5 processors over a 40 gigabit network. This is a real server-grade setup. Check out Linode today at linode.com/doesnotcompute. If you sign up with the offer code DOESNOTCOMPUTE20, DOESNOTCOMPUTE20, they'll give you $20 in credit. That link again is linode.com/doesnotcompute. Give them a try today.
Paul, I've been bitten by the exploratory bug once again. It seems that
what
I
are you exploring?
Brunch build tools.
Brunch. So I think you sent me a link to this. It's a JS build tool.
Yeah. So it is, not to be confused with a cool new brunch app, as I was tweeted at by some restaurant asking me about it. But it is a build tool. And the reason why I like this. Now I know I just talked about Webpack. I was late to the Gulp train, and then I skipped Gulp into Webpack, and now I'm like ricocheting off of Webpack into brunch, into a bowl of hot eggs and cheese, which is a pretty okay landing, if you ask me. But it's basically in a nutshell, it does a lot of things for you. Everything you'd expect a build tool to do, handles file concatenation, handles bundling your JavaScript so you can use requires, which is great, handles linting, handles minifying, all that stuff. It handles copying files from one directory to another, and included in that, it can do image minification for you. And it's really fast. So on the website, it basically talks about how the goal of brunch was to be very fast and to be convention-based over configuration-based. So it's very different from Gulp in the sense that with Gulp, you build your entire tool chain, right? You just pipe things through, you build every step of the way. Whereas with brunch, the most minimal configuration is you have a brunch config file, and then you say JavaScript 2, and then you say CSS 2, app.css, and then it knows to automatically look inside of an app folder for any CSS or JS files, and then it runs all the processors, and then it dumps it to a public folder.
Lately, I've just been using like NPM scripts. So I just NPM run build on all my JS projects. What are some of the advantages of brunch over an approach like that? Something very minimal like what I'm doing right now.
So I think maybe the biggest advantage would be that you can create what they call skeletons. So if I know that I do a lot of statamix sites, I can create a statamix skeleton, and I could do brunch new --/ Sean Wash statamix. And then it'll just set everything up. And then the skeleton file is actually just a GitHub repo where you add a config file or two, and that's that. And granted, you could always just copy and paste, you know, if you're doing the NPM build scripts, like you said, you could just copy and paste that and you could use that as a skeleton. But I think the thing that brunch does well is it combines many different things. So like I mentioned how with Gulp, if you wanted to do image min, you'd have to create a task. If you wanted to do notifying on errors, you have to create a task. If you want to do linting, you have to create a task. If you're using just pure NPM scripts, you can do all that. It just becomes a little bit more verbose. The configuration can kind of become kind of difficult in how you have to write the syntax, you know, in just a string, basically. With brunch, you just give it a brunch config and it makes a bunch of assumptions. And from there, it just goes ahead and does everything. It kind of reminded me of one that I was having my mom use for a while called please. And in that, you give it one file, you say in and out, and then it takes the input and spits it out into where you tell it to go. And the reason why I had her use that was because she needed to get SAS compiling and all that, but I didn't want her to have to focus on building a whole tool chain, you know, when she's learning how to write CSS. I just wanted her to be able to get the end result quicker. And Gulp is great. NPM scripts are great. All that's great. But at the end of the day, I get tired. I've been doing this for a while, and I just want an input and an output, and I want things to be done for me. So that's my idea of why I enjoy brunch over like
NPM scripts. Yeah, I think, you kind of bring up a good point there, because programmers always have different sets of goals when they want to pick a tool or a language that they're going to be using. I think that there are a lot of different approaches to this. And in this particular case, it sounds like you've just decided, hey, this thing works for what I need. It's very easy for me to deal with. I'm going to roll with it. And I think that that's why there are kind of a lot of tools like this. It doesn't mean that everybody needs to be super well-versed in all of them, as long as you're capable enough. But understanding the pluses and minuses of each one and when they might fit well for a particular project, that's a useful skill, I think, in programming, is knowing when to choose the right tool when there are a bunch of different ones available to you. I mean, we've been talking personally a lot about the whole Phoenix and Elixir thing versus Ruby and Rails, and so many people are deciding to jump ship about that, and that's fine. I'm not moving in that direction just yet, but I think it's great that other people are. And it's just, again, comes back to programmers have different goals. I'm looking for a certain thing out of languages and tools that I choose, where other people might not be. Specifically, some of the people I know who are into Elixir and Phoenix right now are really into it because it is new and exciting and different and a new way to look at programming. And I think that's awesome. I'm glad people do that, because that's how we move forward kind of as a community. But at the same time, I'm not using Elixir or Phoenix for side projects I do, because my focus with those side projects is on shipping something, hopefully, versus exploring and look and growing as a programmer. Even a single programmer obviously will have lots of different motivations for why they might choose a language at different points in time even.
Yeah, exactly. There's just different phases that you go through. There's the exploratory phase, like I'm in now with my build tools again. Maybe I never left it. and then there's also the phase where you have an idea that, you know, you just want to ship it. And so I went through an exploratory phase, or kind of still am, with Node and jumping into HappyJS and using that. But what I ended up doing was, one night I got frustrated with SQLize and I rebuilt my Node app in Rails in 2 hours. I had taken a week's worth of work that I did in learning Node, and I rebuilt it quickly just because I wanted to use what I was working on. And that doesn't mean that I think that Node is trash or people shouldn't use it or it's just more difficult than Rails. It's just that at this particular moment, I wanted to use what I was working on, and the fastest way to being able to use it was using a tool that I was familiar with. And I think that's totally okay. You know, I think that we just have to keep in mind when, you know, people are really excited about something, or I guess it's just hard for us to keep in mind when we're really excited about something, to not be dogmatic about it and just say, oh, Rails is dead now. Rails is the old guard, and now Phoenix is coming in and taking over. And if you're not on the boat, then you're missing the boat. I just don't buy into that stuff. It's the same kind of thing that was happening with a lot of the JavaScript tools as well. But it's just kind of, you know, difficult to curb your enthusiasm, I suppose, if you're really excited about something. And it's hard to recognize where other people might be.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned missing the boat, because we've actually talked about this. We'll get a link to it in show notes. There was an article about missing the boat and how that's not actually a big deal, because there's always another boat. If you missed the Polymer boat, well, that's fine. You can just hop on the Angular boat if you want, or the React boat, or the Vue boat. There's so many boats that missing the boat is not really a thing in programming right now.
Right.
Especially in the front-end world, there's always another boat. So you can pick something that you're really comfortable with and that you want to move forward with and that fits your particular needs at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the whole part where you're saying the thing that fits your needs at that moment is the right choice. I 100% agree with that. Completely agree with that. And the interesting thing is that I've been reading a lot of the Rails versus Phoenix stuff, and a lot of people either talk about Active Record or they talk about the SET pipeline. And so yesterday, actually, I was sitting down and I was messing with the Rails app that I'm working on, and I was looking at the JavaScript, and I didn't like how it was turning out, how I was having to use lots of globals to pass information around or pass functions around. So I did a quick Google search. I Googled Browserify Rails, and sure enough, there was a gem, and I installed the gem and refactored my JS, and instantly it felt cleaner. I was like, man, I enjoy this. And it didn't take that much effort. You know, I'm still using Rails. I'm still using all the tools that Rails gives me, except that I'm bypassing most of the asset pipeline and replacing it with a tool that I like to use. And that's perfectly fine. Just because you get frustrated with one part of a framework or a tool.
So, Sean, you sent me this article on GitHub by Elliot Bentley. He's writing about 2014's JavaScript versus today's. And basically, what he was doing back then, 2014's not that long ago, only 2 years, versus what he's doing now. And it's a great read. It's super fun and kind of a nice nostalgic trip looking at how things have changed in general in the JS community in the last 2 years. But it kind of got me thinking a little bit about how my code has changed. And a lot of these ring so true for me. Manually putting in a ton of HTML strings into my JavaScript to render them out instead of properly using templates like I should be. That was a big one. Loading in probably not enough libraries, doing too much not invented here.
I think my favorite part of this article was just the first part where he talks about how he approached just writing JavaScript in general for an application. So he would typically have one big window function called window.ready, which would contain all of the stuff. And I did that too. I did the same thing. I had no concept of splitting code out or, you know, the concept of solid where functions should have a single responsibility and you should use them together. I didn't know anything about that. So what I did was I just had a giant file and that did everything. Everything on window ready, just boom, there it is. It worked okay at the time, but I've learned a lot and, you know, learned about splitting code out into functions. If a function gets too big, you should split it up. Learned about documenting what kind of arguments my functions take. I learned about using JS modules. Just so many. It's crazy because 2 years doesn't seem like a long time. But when I think about 2014, it seems like
terms
a whole
of
lifetime ago.
What JavaScript has become, it's just completely different. It's a totally different landscape. I mean, ES6 wasn't a thing in 2014. Nobody was writing that. And now a fair amount of people are. I don't know if most is accurate, but certainly many. And everything is broken up into modules. Everything is published on NPM. People even publish their own stuff on NPM very often now in order just to use it in another local project they're working on, which I think is awesome. That's so cool that people are releasing so much stuff and there's so many options out there for these things. One thing that was a big deal for me, and this was pre-2014 for me, but just in general for my understanding of programming, is when I switched over to CoffeeScript and I suddenly had access to a lot more of the conventional tools that you would have in other languages, other non-JS languages. Suddenly it was easy for me to split stuff out into actual objects, like actually being able to have the concept of a class in JS without convoluted function encapsulation and prototype stuff at the time was super helpful for me.
Just learning how to use classes in CoffeeScript was a fundamental paradigm shift in my mind, because how I learned how to program was take some PHP from a WordPress theme and just pop it in there and it works. You know, you just copy and paste. And then I would write some CSS and then my JavaScript was just a file of functions. You know, there I had no concept of like newing up a class or newing an instance of a class or any sort of dynamism at all. There was no concept. So I started learning Ruby and started learning more actual programming concepts along with that. And then when I was introduced to CoffeeScript and classes, it really clicked in my mind. I was like, oh, wow, I can make little skeletons and just create new instances of that skeleton and just pass in data.
And I think that's really funny how recently all these OOP, very basic OOP concepts came to the browser. And it's great. It's great to see. But it's funny to think about 2 years basically OOP appearing.
Right. It's even crazier to me. So I was working on my portfolio site a little bit. That's not even live yet, but I was looking through like super old GitHub repos or Bitbucket repos for orgs I used to work with. And I looked at some of the code and I was like, dear God, someone gave me money for this, you know, but it was kind of encouraging at the same time. It's kind of like one of those things where the current stuff that I'm working on is difficult and I don't necessarily feel totally confident. But when I go back and even look at a project that's a year old, I feel like I've grown so much. And in what was great about this article, as I was reading through it, it forced me to realize things that I've learned. So I felt kind of good. I felt uplifted after reading it. Like, and I have progressed. I have learned that the code that I'm writing today is better than the code that I was writing a month ago. And I think reflections like
that's
that
one
are
of my
always,
favorite things about
important.
Programming. I absolutely love looking back at my code from 6 months ago or a year ago or 2 years ago. And saying, oh man, that guy did not know what he was doing. And then I love, again, in 6 months from now, I'll be able to look back on the stuff I was writing today and be like, wow, I'm so much better now. And that's a great feeling. That's how you know you're progressing. And you have very concrete evidence of your progression because you leave these code artifacts behind, especially when you publish stuff on GitHub or what have you. Just having that out there in the world and being able to go back and look at it later, it gives you a very good reference to see how quickly and efficiently you're growing.
Another one of the great things about programming is that feeling of just never being a master of what you're doing, never being able to fully master programming. Your whole paradigm just shifts. It's like it's in the show It's Always Sunny, that bell, when any of the characters realize something, there's that gong sound and they pause for a second and they have a blank stare, you know? I mean, the most recent one for me was when I started learning how to use Vue or looking at React a little bit. At first, I was like, why would you need this? And then the gong happened or the glass shattered and I was like, oh my goodness, where has this been my whole life, you know? One example was an old client that I had, and he listens to the show, friend of the show, Brady Swenson, will probably laugh at this, but one of the first big Ajax UI pieces I made was building a big calendar, and the calendar would show events, and you could go forward and backwards and open certain days and look at data on certain days and edit data from certain days. I did this with jQuery and a few Ajax requests and manually updated
the It's very funny myself. To me how much of the web got away with code like that for how long. And things kept working fine, which is the interesting part to me, that we had all these things that should have never, they were so duct taped together. And I think every programmer is guilty of this. Every programmer who's done some JS things has at one point absolutely just MacGyvered something that in no way should work. You've put together this hang glider out of like two sticks of bamboo and some duct tape and a plastic sheet, and you're actually flying on it.
And then any aerospace engineer seeing from a distance with gaping mouths, they're like, what is happening over there? They're just watching, you know? And the crazy thing is, you're right, it worked. Like, it worked. I mean, it takes longer to iron out bugs because you can't possibly find all the bugs, especially if you're manually updating stuff with jQuery. But it worked, and that was a crazy thing. So now, when I'm looking at that through the lens of knowing that I can use JavaScript tools like Vue or React to have the UI just update to state, because that was honestly the first real big project I had to work on where there was lots of state. I didn't know what state was. I remember we had a meeting or something and you were kind of like wireframing how this calendar might work. And I was like, yep, makes sense. I had no idea. I was like, I think it makes sense, but I don't know enough to know that it doesn't make
sense. Building something equivalent to a single page app is, I think, kind of one of those moments where you really figure out if you want to keep programming or not. Because it's a bit of a challenge the first time or two, for sure.
Yeah, the first time you get an infinite scrolling PSD or PSD that's like, oh, you can just scroll this infinitely. And then you start to think of all the edge cases and it just grows. It's like a little iceberg, you know? You see, it's just an infinite scrolling thing. And then below the water is like, what happens when someone hits the back button? What happens when someone clicks into an article and hits the back button? What happens when someone wants to share the current screen they're on? What happens when A, B, C, D, E, F, G? And then you just kind of feel like you're getting buried. Problems like that are always difficult because you feel like, how am I ever going to solve this? But problems like that are good because it kind of forces you to learn how to deal with that. That feeling of, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how I'm going to figure out how to do this, etc. It's kind of like weightlifting. The heavier the weights get, you know, obviously it gets more difficult, but your body responds to that. And your mind kind of responds
to that
as well.
So you sent me this link to a draft on the CSS Working Group website. And this is for something called CSS... will change. Will change is something that is being introduced in order to help users more nicely tell the browser, hey, I'm going to be animating a property on this element. That's the gist of it. That's a very high level overview. But effectively, you will be able to use will change to say, hey, will change opacity on an element. Then what the browser will do in response to that, it will actually promote that element that matches that selector up to its own rendering layer. So it will actually be able to redraw it more efficiently without disturbing the layout of the entire page, that sort of thing. And the implementations, obviously, it's kind of one of those nice features where the browser can become more intelligent over time and just do the right thing without you having to think about or worry about it, which is really cool, I think. This is something that we've kind of needed for quite a while, so it's great to see it get into the drafts here.
Yeah, and the use case is actually really simple, you know. You just toss it onto an element, or a selector rather, and it does its job. Now, that's not without some considerations, and the reason I actually sent this article to you, Paul, was because there's a whole section on using it. So I remember a blog post by AeroTwist, which I'll link, that kind of introduced the property to me. Apparently, from there, people have seen that and taken it and run with it and have done things like star selector will change. Just apply that to everything. The cool part about this using section is it says, don't do that. And here's why. So not only does this particular part of the draft talk about what this does and why it does it, but also how you should go about using it, because it's, you know, they've observed people abusing this. But essentially it talks about, you know, don't apply it across too many things, because if you tell the browser it needs to optimize literally everything on the page, that's not really an optimization. You know, the computer is just going to have to work much, much harder. And then another little tip it says is use will change sparingly in style sheets. So apparently the actual use case for will change was to be applied and removed via JavaScript. So if you know that something is going to have to transform in a certain way, you can apply that to the element and then remove it when you're done using it. Also, on top of that, it says, if you add will change, don't expect it to work instantly. You need to make sure there's at least a little bit of a buffer on this. And it gives the example of maybe if you have an effect on a button when you click on it, you could say, when you hover over this button, will change opacity. And then on the button active, actually change that. And so that would work. But what wouldn't work is if on hover, you say, will change opacity, and then adjust opacity right away. Basically, the computer doesn't have enough time to see that it needs to optimize something. And also,
this whole thing is actually a really good reminder for me of just how good all the working group websites are. Like, all the W3C drafts and stuff are generally very good reads. They seem like they would be highly technical, and some parts of them certainly are, when they talk about how you implement these features in a browser, all that kind of stuff you need to be able to do. And that does get a bit technical, probably more than most people need to care about. But overall, these are always super good to read. If you want to stay up on latest web technologies and kind of the things that are going to be implemented over the next, you know, year or however long, couple years, it's so nice to be able to go through here and see the exact description of how will change is supposed to work, how you're supposed to use it, how browsers are going to be implementing it, if you want to read about that. I think that's awesome. So this is such a huge resource that I feel like a lot of people don't look at very often. And I just want to encourage people, go check out W3C drafts and stuff like that, because it's a great way to learn about upcoming features.
Well, I think it's the best way to learn about that stuff. So my initial education of CSS was solely based off of blogs, like the CSS Tricks Almanac, maybe. And that's definitely not official material. You know, it's not official documentation. So I've been trying to spend more time going back and looking through the specifications. And actually this morning I found an article, and I'll put it in the show notes, but the article was explaining how to actually read the docs for the CSS spec and the HTML spec. It basically outlines the spec or the way of writing the documentation that this was all based off of. And then it outlines, this is how you actually would read how it talks about like the input type and the arguments that something takes, etc. So if you do find the W3C stuff pretty dense and hard to understand, I'll toss that link in there and be sure to check it out, because it will definitely make your experience in reading through the drafts much easier. So Paul, I know we've been talking a lot about functional CSS, or at least mentioning it a fair bit, and there's also lots of hot drama going on the internet about it, people for, people against. It turns out people's ideas...
Well, there's only one right idea about everything, Sean. Come on.
There was an article posted on A List Apart written by Tim Baxter, who was basically saying, you know, why do we need to do all this stuff? Why do we need all these class selectors when you can just use element selectors and simplify things? And when I first read that, I was like, that's kind of strange, because this would not work for a lot of the projects I work on. They're just bigger than that. This would introduce a lot of problems. And I didn't really think much of it. I stayed away from the comments, as I tried to do. And this morning I came across this article by Jonathan Snook, who always writes great stuff. But the title was called More Meaningful CSS. And I like this article a lot. It's short and concise, and he provides real world examples as to why using element selectors or just trying to slim that stuff down just wouldn't work for him. And I see a lot of articles talking about the ideas behind functional CSS or BEMS or UU CSS or whatever. And maybe the articles that I've seen don't have a lot of practical examples, but I really appreciated that he took some time to actually say, well, in my days at Shopify, we had this certain problem and this is how we dealt with it. And with how Mr. Baxter is referring to writing CSS, it just wouldn't work for my case. Because there's a lot of either black and white, right? There's a lot of people who are saying, well, you don't need all that junk, it just doesn't work. And there's a lot of people who are saying, we don't know what you're talking about because your ideas aren't going to work for us. My second favorite thing about this article actually happens to come from a comment, which he kind of talked about a few different things, but the bottom of the comment, he says, and as always, the most important things are be consistent and don't be dogmatic.
Yeah, especially with CSS, because it is such a battlefield in a lot of ways right now. I think that consistency is your best friend in any CSS code base for sure. What I've found personally is that, you know, styling based on the actual tag name, element selectors in CSS, that does work to an extent, but as a site grows, a lot of the problems that he's talking about come up. Like if you want to make a design change on certain pages of a site, element selectors kind of lock you out of that. Unless you switch to including certain CSS files on certain pages and others on different pages, at which point you have two diverging CSS code bases effectively within the same actual code base. And so then that gets very confused. And if you add another redesign at another point, then you'll have a third branch of this code and it gets super unwieldy. So avoiding stuff like that actually, for me, is a lot of why immutable CSS makes sense. People talk about this. Once a selector is written, that selector is in the books and it's set and you can't change it. You have to add another. I think that that does kind of solve a lot of issues with CSS in general. And obviously that can be a bit tough because if you aren't using something where, as John Gold would say, all the CSS is already written, then you probably will end up with way too many selectors in a very bloated CSS code base. But if you have something like base CSS, like Tachyons, where most everything is already written, most of all the CSS is done, and you really don't need to add anymore, then this isn't really a concern because it doesn't matter that it's immutable. It's already all there.
Exactly. And another example that Mr. Snook talks about in the article is he says that there was a period of time where they were redesigning some portions of the checkout flow and they were using the input element selector. And because of that, they actually had to write CSS to undo the CSS that it was inheriting and then reapply the new styles. So that way they weren't breaking other places of the site, which outlines that case exactly. Like this, I mean, that approach probably works for, you know, small sites or smaller projects, not unimportant projects, but smaller projects. And it's just a different set of problems that you have to solve as your project grows or as your team members grow. Like you said, Paul, if you have a selector, it's set, it's in the books. That's the absolute truth for that selector because it's just defined in one place, right? Whereas if you have lots of cascading CSS, you might have things defined in multiple files in multiple different places. And it's not immediately apparent as to which was the first and why it was the first and why these other ones were added. And to the point where you're talking about, you know, as projects grow and you're using stuff like element selectors, the CSS tends to grow because then you have to write more to hit your redesign cases or more to hit your specific cases for certain pages. And one thing I talked about recently in one of the Octopus dev teams was using the tool csstats.com to kind of check out how things are going. You know, check out if there's lots of CSS that's not being used, if things are getting bloated, if you have too many colors or too many font sizes, or if things are getting too specific. That site will show you all of that as a specificity graph, which is great. It shows you lots of numbers, basically, how many selectors there are versus how many are actually used on the site. And it's a great tool. And I was feeling kind of bad. So a larger project I'm working on, the CSS for that site is 120K. And that's including the CSS util library that I've been working on. That's also including a bunch of vendor CSS as well. And at first I was like, oh, that's a lot of CSS. I should see what I can do to, you know, shrink it up. And then I started clicking on the example sites they list, like GitHub or CNN or Airbnb and Apple and Google and all that. And I started realizing consistently my CSS using functional CSS was easy, 3 times smaller. I think CNN.com is shipping 1.9 megabytes of CSS currently, which is crazy. So again, with what the article says, you know, it all depends on what kind of project you're working on and the situation you're in. But just be mindful, just be consistent, and don't be dogmatic.
Thanks to today's sponsor, Linode. If you need affordable, reliable virtual machines in the cloud, Linode is definitely worth a look. They make it super fast and easy to spin up virtual machines for just about anything you need. Their SSD-backed servers start at just $10 per month, and you get full root access, so you can do pretty much anything with them, like set up a private VPN or Git server. Visit linode.com/doesnotcompute to learn more. Sign up with the offer code doesnotcompute20, and they'll give you $20 of Linode credit to start experimenting. If you enjoy Does Not Compute, make sure to rate or review the show on iTunes. It just takes a second and really helps spread the word.
It's like, I dropped my pizza on the floor, Paul. I